There we go. We're on the air, and my guest is E. Michael Jones. E. Michael Jones is the author of many excellent books. My favorites are Degenerate Moderns. I also like your book on the history of the terror genre. I am presently reading The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Let me hold it up. Thank you very much. And its impact on world history. As usual, Michael, I find that your work is a tremendous history, and it's a very great panoramic sweep, not only of history, but also culture. And I'm enjoying the book. I mean, I'm about halfway through. I read 3 or 4 pages a day because I'm very busy, but I'm up to the part which is really what I was waiting for, which is the false Jewish Messiah, Shabtai Zvi. I didn't know his background, but it's very interesting to me. And also Oliver Cromwell. I take issue with your premise, however, and I do so with the goal of, I don't want to get into a disputation of Tortosa here, you know, because I do have a Jewish perspective, and I'm not, my goal here is not to in any way question, you know, get into issues of Christology or anything like that. That's a Christian issue, not a Jewish issue.
Right.
As I see it. However, to understand your premise, we have to go back to the time of Jesus. And your premise being that, from what I gather, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, that Judaism at that time, because of its rejection of Jesus' ministry and its rejection of Jesus as his divine claims, it reinvented itself as a new religion, and that it was a religion that was not only revolutionary, but that it was a reaction to Jesus, and it was based upon the principle of its rejection of Jesus. And I'd like you to expound upon that a little bit in the context that I don't agree with it, although I respect this as a traditional Catholic view.
Yeah, I think that in order to discuss it fully and accurately, we have to bring the word logos into the discussion. Logos is the Greek word for speech, for rationality, for the order of the universe. It takes up 5 pages in a Greek English dictionary to give you all of the equivalents in English that we use when we talk about the word logos. Heraclitus had brought this word into the philosophical vocabulary in Ephesus in 500 BC, where he said that there was logos and there was fire. And logos was the plan, and I think fire, in his understanding, was the basic element, but this was the plan in action. So there was a plan in time. Anyway, the turning point in history came when St. John, seeing that St. Paul failed at the Areopagus to address the Greeks in their language, wrote the prologue to his gospel, and he had to use the word logos. He said, in the beginning there was logos. It's translated traditionally as, in the beginning, there was the word. But that doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can't understand what's going on here unless you go back to the original Greek word, which is logos. So in the beginning, there was logos. And logos was with God. And logos is God. Logos is God. This is a complete change in the way anyone was talking about this up to this point. And at this point, Christianity united the Hebrew tradition and the Greek tradition into a new type of synthesis. And I'm saying, so Jesus Christ is the Logos. He's not, and the Logos is a being. It's a creature. It's not just a plan. It's not just geometry. It's an actual human being that is the implementation or the epitome of this plan of the universe. So the Jews killed Christ, okay? When they killed Christ, they killed the Logos, or they attempted to kill the Logos. And when you reject the Logos, you're rejecting the order of the universe. And when you reject the order of the universe, which means the social order as well as the physical order, you become a revolutionary. And I'm saying that's what Jews have been ever since this time. And that's the premise of the Jewish revolutionary spirit.
Okay, and here's where I understand that view. From a Catholic perspective, after all, if Jesus was the Messiah, then yes, he had Logos. And that even historically, I mean, as a Jew, I recognize that Jesus had a logos all over the place. I mean, I don't think there are too many people who have ever walked the earth who had more logos than Jesus. There was a tremendous meaning there. There was a tremendous greater sense of purpose, and there was a tremendous spirituality there. However, I would suggest that the Jewish people also have logos, and that any individual can have logos if they have a meaning to life. I mean, I look to Jewish psychologist Viktor Frankl, who wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And he developed what's called logotherapy based on logos.
Right.
He survived Auschwitz, and he came out and said, this is how I survived. I understood my purpose in the world. I understood. And he was a religious Jew, by the way, who wrapped tefillin every morning. And, you know, that the problem with Freud, who he had a falling out with, was that Freud believed in the pleasure principle, that everything in existence was there to make you happy, for pleasure. And then he talked about Adler, who was influenced by Nietzsche, who believed in the principle of will. And that, of course, is the totalitarian principle. Whereas Frankl embraced the concept of logos, which I think is totally in Jewish custom. And that is that the individual has the capability to understand meaning, to understand existence, and to perceive it, and then to order their life in such a way as to pursue it within the context of what's possible.
Yeah, well, you're not just talking about Jews. Every human being is a rational creature. That's the essence of what we are. We are a creature of logos. And the fact that we're talking with each other right now is a sign that we share this logos. We can talk. You can say something. I can understand what you're saying. I can respond. You can understand what I'm saying. Yeah, that's logos. That's right. You're absolutely right. It's not just the Jewish people. It's every single person on the face of the earth was created by God as a rational creature. In this way, human beings are different than animals. Human beings are the only creatures that can talk to each other. Animals bark and they squeal and they do all kinds, make all kinds of noises, but they don't talk to each other about abstract concepts like speech and logos. So yeah, that's nothing unique to the Jewish people. Nothing whatsoever unique there.
I haven't claimed it is.
Mankind. What is unique to the Jewish people? They were chosen by God. They are God's chosen people. Okay. God singled them out as a special group of people, and he talked to them face to face, now almost face to face. And we're talking about someone like Moses. Okay. Moses goes up and there's a burning bush and it's God speaking to him. I mean, this is something special. God didn't do this to anybody else. He's talking to Moses. Moses is a little bit intimidated. He says, well, tell me who you are. He said, I am who am. This is something that no other group of people on the face of the earth ever heard.
Right.
The Jews are completely unique in this regard because they were given this revelation directly from God. That is completely unique. No one else had that opportunity. Sure. So we have to establish why the Jews are unique, okay? Because they had revelation. The Greeks did not have revelation. The Greeks had to figure this out on their own, okay, without any help from God directly. And so they started talking about, well, maybe it's, what's the earth, what's this whole universe made of? Is it water? That's what Thales said. Is it air? That's what Anaxagoras said. Is it fire? That's what Heraclitus said. And gradually they came to their own understanding that it wasn't anything physical. That this God could not be something physical. And Aristotle finally came to the whole point. He's the uncaused cause and the unmoved mover. Everything depends on him. And so what I'm saying here is that St. John took these two traditions and brought them together in Christianity with the word logos. Okay, that's why we're talking about logos. Now, I said, simply because of the fact that we're human beings, we are talking together and we have a certain level of logos, that's not the upper limit. And what you see over this period of time is people trying to come to a deeper and deeper understanding of the meaning of logos. Aristotle took it to a completely different level. It's nothing physical. It is the uncaused cause and the unmoved mover. Plato said it had to be something above the physical realm, and that's where it stood. And Plato said, well, if we just contemplate essences, we'll rise to that level all by ourselves. Well, it didn't work. And so what you see here at a certain point with both Greeks and Jews is that they said, we're going to do it our way. And Jesus Christ said, no, you got to do it my way. Because right. Jesus Christ came down. You can't go up. This is what St. Augustine realized. I can't do it. Man, you can't rise to that level. Plato had the right idea, but you can't do it. So there's no point even talking about it anymore because it's obsolete anyway because Jesus Christ came down. And so what you see throughout history is people achieving groups of people, nations, achieving a certain level of logos and then stopping. It stopped. And I'm saying that the Greeks stopped. There were the Plotinus and Porphyry. They both existed after Jesus Christ came on this earth. And they said, we're going to do it the way Plato said. And St. Augustine said, no, you can't do it. It's obsolete. You're barking up an obsolete tree. And the Jews did the same thing. They said, we're going to do it our way. Annas and Caiaphas said, they stood at the foot of the cross and they said to Jesus Christ, if you come down from the cross, we'll accept you as the Messiah. Mm-hmm. Okay. In other words, you've got to do it our way. If you don't do it our way, we don't want to have anything to do with you. And so they stopped the Jewish religion, the Hebrew religion. Let me talk about the Hebrew religion. Stopped there. The temple was destroyed. So you don't have that religion anymore. You can't fulfill that religion anymore because you don't have a temple. You don't have a priesthood and you don't have a sacrifice. And Yochanan ben Zakkai, the rabbi at this point, understood that. And he escaped from Jerusalem under siege at the time of Titus. He went to Titus and said, I'm a friend of Rome. I want you to do me a favor. I want to start a school. And this is the beginning of Judaism as we know it now. This is the synagogue Judaism and not the temple Judaism. It's younger than Christianity. It came after Christianity. And that's the attempt of Jews to try and have a religion without a temple, without a priesthood, without a sacrifice. And that, in my humble opinion, it's the dead end that the Jews landed in. And because they couldn't accept it, they became revolutionaries. And that's what the Jews have been ever since, revolutionaries.
Okay, well, first of all, I mean, Aristotle arrived at the principle of primus mobile, which is God, actually, and that Jews embraced, I would contend, Greek knowledge long before Jesus. I mean, we could go back to Alexander the Great's conquest of Judea.
Philo of Alexandria is a classic.
Philo of Alexandria, exactly. And also,
what you're talking about.
Right. And I would also contend that the Talmud, which is not in any way contradictory to the Torah, and which is basically an expostulation of Torah principles in a manner that we can live by them and function and understand them at a deeper level, entirely uses Greek methodology in its approach to issues. And that, in fact, the synagogue Judaism goes back hundreds of years before the destruction of the temple. It goes back to really as far back, they say, as Ezra, who came back from the Babylonian conquest and who built the second temple. But it also, in reality, goes back to Hellenic times when the temple became perverted. It was taken over, and Jesus was absolutely right to go into the temple and start throwing out the criminals and the money lenders and whatnot. It had become secularized. It was taken over by a secular sect of Jews called the Sadducees. The Pharisees then at that point, and this was in the time of really right after Judah Maccabee, in the time of Simon and John Hyrcanus, they developed the synagogue system as a counterpoint to the corruption of the temple because they had lost control of the temple. So the synagogue system is something, and the synagogue is nothing more than it's not a temple, nor does it claim to be. It is a place of learning. It is a place of worship. And it is a place by which the Jews can continue worshiping in the same way the Catholics continue worshiping Jesus through the Mass. It's not a contradiction. You know, yes, we don't have the sacrifice and we pray for the rebuilding of the temple, But the synagogue allows for a means of worship without the sacrifice until we return and redevelop the sacrifice. And it was developed before the destruction of the Second Temple. So I would suggest to you that Rabbinic Judaism, as it's called, Talmudic Judaism, it was around long before Jesus, and it continues to this day. And one of the contradictions I see in your work, which is brilliant and which I admire, is that you point out revolutionary movements in Christianity. And by the way, I consider Judaism to be very conservative and not revolutionary, and that a lot of the revolutionary Jews are heretics as much as Christian revolutionaries. But you point out that, like, for example, the Albigensian heresy and the Hussite movement by John Huss in Bavaria, and more radical elements of the Reform, like Thomas Munster and the Anabaptists and Cromwell, that you refer to them as Judaizing, even though it's scant evidence that Jews actually had anything to do with it. But you say philosophically that they were Judaizing because they were doing a very strict, literal interpretation of the Torah. And yet you also claim that Calvinism is Judaizing because you say that it embraced the Talmud. What I would suggest here is that the literal strict interpretation of the Torah is a heresy in Judaism, because you need the Talmud, you need the rabbis who are qualified and who are holy, and you need responsa in order to understand the Torah. It's not to be taken as a literal word. There was a heresy within Judaism in the 19th century called the Karaite movement, which broke away and insisted that they live literally by the Torah. It was one of the great schisms in Judaism. So, you know, the fact that some Christian groups decided to go to a literal interpretation of the Torah and say, well, we have a right to conquer people as if they're Canaanites, that's nothing to do with Judaism. That's a heresy in Judaism.
Right. It is. It is. I agree with you. But I'm saying that what happened at this period of time is that the Bible got disconnected from the church. So in a sense, I agree with you that no individual can interpret the Bible properly without some type of ecclesial structure. And right. I can see what you're saying, that the Talmud is an attempt to do this. But I don't agree with you that the Talmud is consistent with the Torah. I don't agree. Okay. I think that the Talmud is a perversion of the Torah. I think that, I don't know where I read this, but I mean, at some point, more than once during the research that I was doing over 10 years ago, I came across the phrase, whatever the Torah forbids, the Talmud permits. And
that's untrue.
I came across it more than once.
It's untrue. You studied the Talmud? You should talk to a Talmudic rabbi. I mean, that is simply not the case. It doesn't permit stuff that the Torah, you know, it basically puts things in a context that it can be practiced. Now, you also get into the claim that the Talmud has insulting comments about Jesus.
Right.
First of all, I don't think so. I mean, I've done some research on it. You're talking about a book called Toledot Yeshu, which you also mentioned, which does have insulting analysis of Jesus. It's not Talmud. It's a book. And yes, it's not. I'm not proud of the fact that it was written and that Jews look to it. That's not good. However, the Talmud itself doesn't say anything insulting or anything at all about Jesus. There's one quote in the Talmud that was mentioned by Nicholas Donen when he met with the Pope, which said that Jesus is burning in hell in human excrement.
Yeah.
That's not a reference to Jesus, from what I understand, and I've consulted with some people about that. That was written by Onkelos. Now, Onkelos was a Roman. He was a pagan, and he was more than just a pagan. He was involved in Roman worship and some kind of occult. And then he converted to Judaism, and he became a very good Jew, I mean, a very revered Talmudic contributor to the Talmud. He wrote that in reference to the times when he was involved with all kinds of garbage about, you know, pagan worship. And it was not about Jesus. Now, that's one theory about it. And I would tell you what the reason I think that's probably true is because, first of all, the Jewish understanding of hell is not an anthropomorphic place where people burn in hell, you know, in excrement. It's just we don't view it as something where stuff goes on like that. It's not that that's actually more, frankly, a Christian view of hell. You know, the Jewish view of hell is a little bit fuzzier than that. We don't know what it's like. We know it exists, but it's not those comments are not consistent with the Jewish understanding of hell. That's more consistent with pagan views at the time. So I honestly don't think that that comment had to do with Jesus in the Talmud.
This has come up. You remember the disputation at Tortosa.
Yes.
The Jews were forced to come in and sit down there as the priest went through the Talmud and pointed out one passage after another. And finally, the rabbi had to about Jesus in the Talmud. And finally, the rabbi said, no, it's not that Jesus. It's another Jesus.
And oh, I know.
One of the commentators said this was the beginning of Jewish humor. This is also part of Jewish history here. If you read Heinrich Graetz, the father of Jewish historiography, he has a long, eloquent passage in there where he talks about how the morals of Polish Jews have been corrupted by studying the Talmud, because all the Talmud taught them to do was to cheat and steal.
Now, well, look, Heinrich Graetz, as much as...
Are you going to dispute Heinrich Graetz?
Yes, I am. He was a good historian, and he was an admirable Jew, but he also had an animus toward religious Jews, particularly in Poland. He was a German Enlightenment, what they call the Haskalah. He was a Haskalah figure who wanted to modernize Judaism. I think he meant well, but he had an animus toward, particularly toward Polish Jewry, which he looked down on as ignorant and whatnot. And he was not comfortable. You know, he was an assimilationist. He was not comfortable with religious people. So you have to view him in that context.
A Jew who had been influenced by the Enlightenment. There were refugees. I mentioned Solomon Maimon, his memoir of growing up in Lithuania under the tyranny of the rabbis. He found refuge in Berlin with Moses Mendelssohn. There's a whole tradition of basically what you're talking about. That's true. You're absolutely right. But I'm saying over the big picture, what emerges out of this big picture? I'm saying the only continuity that you can find in Jewish history is the Jewish revolutionary spirit. It's not part of the religious tradition, although it can be part of this religious tradition. It transcends this tradition. I'm saying it's what unifies this whole 2,000-year period of history.
It's an interesting precept. I disagree with it in that Judaism is a belief in the Almighty God. It's a conservative belief. It's not involved in revolutionary activity, and that the revolutionaries that you're talking about are heretics.
What about Simon Bar Kokhba?
Well, that was during the time of Jesus. He came around less than 100 years after Jesus was crucified. And that came, well, that came around at the tail end of the Messianic movement, which was happening. Jesus was part of that. I mean, it was, you know, before and after Jesus, there was a lot of people who were coming around claiming to be Messiah. And I would say that Bar Kokhba was the last one in that area. That was an anomaly in Jewish history. But you're right in that you point out that the Jewish understanding of Messiah is different than the Christian understanding, at least as it stands now. But you're missing a part of it. You're missing the fact that the Jewish understanding of the Messiah is that the Jewish people have to reach a level of spirituality and doing good deeds, or doing mitzvahs and belief in God and you know, a certain level of knowledge and education to set the stage for the coming of the Messiah, who will be a man, and it will have to also accompany the return to Israel, the ingathering of the exiles to that tiny little swath of land that you, by the way, inaccurately historically call Palestine. But I don't want to go there. But it's that, and then there is the beginning of the rebuilding of the temple. Now, historically, and I think that you know, you understand this, Cyrus the Great of Persia was called a Messiah in the book of Ezra because he helped bring the Jewish people back to Israel, back to Judea, which is what it was called back then. And he gave them authority to rebuild the temple. You know, he gave them, actually, the actual edict is in the book of Ezra.
Right.
Now, that is why he's called a Messiah, because he helped further this process. But it's a spiritual process. It is political and even military, maybe, only in the sense that the Jew, going all the way back to Abraham, is obligated to take possession of that tiny little swath of land. Now, I don't claim to understand that. It's a mystery to me. But that's what the Torah says from beginning to end. It's not to conquer the world. It's not to be revolutionary. It's simply to, once they're in that little piece of land, which they are in today, it's then it's the obligation of the Jew to worship God and to be spiritual and to, you know, try to live to the precepts of the moral and ethical code of the Torah, which will then bring about the Messianic Age. And by the way, I think Christianity believes in this too, to a certain extent.
Well, was Simon Bar Kokhba the Messiah or not?
He was not he was a false Messiah. And there were several back then.
He was recognized by all of the rabbis at that time as the Messiah.
He was not. He was recognized by some of the rabbis who were fooled and who were brought into this false messianic movement, just like people was fooled by Shabtai Zvi. And it
Shabtai Zvi recognized by the rabbis as the Messiah?
By some rabbis, but he was totally rejected by the mainstream rabbis in Judaism, who fought against that and who fought against his Sabbatian legacy tooth and nail. There was a whole civil war in Judaism over that.
That's not my understanding. My understanding is that the overwhelming majority of the rabbis recognized Shabbatai Zvi
as false. No, they did not. I would recommend that you read a book by Rabbi Marvin Antleman called To Eliminate the Opiate. He gets into this and this amazing civil war that took place in Judaism to reject and to stop this movement and its aftermath. And then you had Jacob Frank and these other phonies who came along. They were communists. They were not. Shabtai Zvi proved his messiahship by engaging in perversion at the Bima. He was excommunicated by his own rabbi in Smyrna. They were not recognized by the rabbis. It became a popular movement. It was like a craze. It was like a rock band. He traveled around. He was like the Rolling Stones. You know, it became
a lot of Jews sold their property in Europe.
Yes, they got sucked into it.
Turkey, because the Messiah had arrived.
And a lot of Christians followed Thomas Munster. I mean, this was a charismatic movement that was a complete departure from conventional Torah true Judaism. And he even said so himself. He says, I'm going to prove my messiahship by desecrating the Torah and by engaging in orgies and all this other crap that he did. Right. It was not accepted. I mean, Judaism was at a low ebb at that point, as you point out, because of the Kamelniki massacre and the several other things. The people might have been more vulnerable to it. But
it led to widespread disillusionment among the Jews. I mean, it was a catastrophe. The Jewish encyclopedia says it was the second greatest catastrophe after the destruction of the temple. It wouldn't have been a catastrophe unless a lot of Jews went along with him thinking he was the Messiah.
They did. A lot of non-Jews even believed he was the Messiah. But look, it was still a heretical movement. The rabbis, most of whom rejected it. And I mean, some people got sucked into it. I mean, people got sucked into, it's like people got sucked into the mortgage meltdown in 2007. They started to sell all their money and buy these phony mortgages. It was like a mass movement, but it was not conventional Judaism. And, you know, he obviously proved to be a phony. I mean, when the Sultan of Turkey put him on the spot, he sold his soul.
He converted to Islam.
Exactly. Because he was given a choice, either convert to Islam or die.
Right.
But look, the point is that the idea of the Jewish Messiah is not a physical conqueror of the world. He's not going to be coming here to physically, forcibly transform man. That's a communist idea. That was rejected by the rabbis. It's rejected by Judaism. In fact, the entire edifice of Judaism rejects that. It is somebody who is going to come only if the Jewish people peaceably become more spiritual, more observant, more, you know, doing good, you know, raise their level of spirituality. And the Torah gives us the keys in terms of how to do that.
I just got a letter to the editor from a Jew who's telling me exactly the same thing that you're telling me. He's trying to blame all of the problems that I'm talking about on secular Jews. Okay. That these secular movements are the problem. There are lots of Jews that don't agree with these secular movements. I was in Tehran. Rabbi David Weiss was there. He's part of Netarai Karta. He's saying something similar. Okay. Mm-hmm. Basically that there was, he's a total anti-Zionist.
Okay? I know that. Yeah.
And I got to talk to him, and I said, when I was there, I said to the group that was assembled there, I said, well, if all the Jews were like Rabbi Weiss, we wouldn't have a problem. But the problem is that the Jews are not like that. That we have Jews Jewish messianic political movements like neoconservatism that basically took over the foreign policy of the country and led us into war. And now we're being pushed into more and more wars as a result of this. And we're not allowed to talk about it. That's the problem. As soon as I say the word Jew, as neoconservatism is a Jewish political movement, or Bolshevism is a political movement, or Sheldon Adelson is a Jew, or the reason we don't have an Iran agreement is because of Sheldon Adelson and two other rich Jews who contributed to Trump's campaign. As soon as I say that, people call me an anti-Semite. And this is to shut down any type of discussion. I'm saying this is not a healthy situation. We cannot go on this way. I mean, what we're doing today is the antidote to what I'm talking about here, where we can sit and we can talk to each other about these problems. But that's not the norm here. We are the exception. We are not the rule. The rule is anytime you say something, you're called an anti-Semite and they kick you out of YouTube. My videos are being censored because I said, for example, that the Kavanaugh hearings were a Catholic-Jewish battle. This is not going to bode well. This is not going to, we need to form some way of talking about these issues rather than simply excommunicating people, putting a haram on somebody and trying to stop the discussion.
I agree with that. I mean, that's why I'm having you here. And that's why I'm reading your book. And I respect your opinion. I think it's an Orthodox Catholic opinion. I simply don't agree with it. And okay. As far as, you know, we could point to individual Jews who are involved with stuff that we don't agree with. We could point to individual Christians, too. I mean, Barack Obama is a Christian, right? I mean, Bill Clinton was a Christian, is a Christian. Right. I mean, who are any one of us to say not? I mean, they profess to be, and I accept that. The point is that these ideas of internationalism and globalism, this isn't a Jewish idea. It may be Jews in name who embrace it. People like George Soros, who I view a very evil man. But they've embraced communist principles that are anathema to Judaism. And this, by the way, and you may agree with me on this, it's a stain on Jewish, modern Jewish history that we did embrace communism to the degree that so many Jews did. I would say in the same way that it's a stain on Christian history that they embrace Nazism. These things are political anti-religious heresies. They don't recognize the existence of a creator of the universe. Instead, they want to create an earthly utopia by force. That is completely contrary to Jewish ideas. And yet Jews have been sucked into this in the same way that Christians have been. And the problem, and I thought this of your work up until this book, I think you were pointing it out exactly. The problem is communism and collectivism and this idea of grabbing the fruit of the tree of knowledge by Eve and claiming to be God on earth. It's a complete heresy to Judaism.
There's a sense in which this is the way I used to think. I mean, I had pretty much the same point of view And then the crisis for me came in 2003, when suddenly America's in the Iraq War. Okay. And I'm thinking, how is this possible? I couldn't believe that it was happening. And then I started talking, then people started talking about neoconservatives. And I kept thinking, well, what's a neoconservative? And then they say, well, how about Irving Kristol? And I thought, okay, Irving Kristol was a Trotskyite.
Yeah, they were all Trotskyites.
Oh, wait a minute. No, he was a Trotskyite in the 1930s.
Right.
And now in the 1990s or the 2000s, he's a conservative. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. You can't understand this politically. There's no political coherence. What's the coherence here? And I said, well, it's Jewish, because Bolshevism was a Jewish messianic movement, and neoconservatism is a Jewish messianic movement. And at that point, I began to be able to make connections that I could not make before. And so the point here is there a Jew? Are there Jews out there? I mean, the story I keep hearing is where three Jews, you find four different opinions. Well, the group disappears. Is there a group out there that we can identify as Jews? Do they act in history?
Yes, most Jews.
Do they do?
Most, first of all, you're talking about messianic movements that happen to attract some people who happen to have Jewish backgrounds, and Christians and others who have the same, you know, their own respective backgrounds. It's not a Jewish movement. I mean, Dick Cheney is not a Jew.
Why is
right? I mean, George Bush was not a Jew.
Who?
They're the ones that did the Iraq War. George Bush, Dick Cheney. I mean, you know, it's not a Jewish conspiracy. There were Jews involved in it, or people who have Jewish backgrounds. But it's not like this isn't some kind of a Jews aren't advocating world conquest. I mean, look, this is your premise here. We're talking about internationalists. I mean, were the founders of the UN Jewish? Was Alger Hiss Jewish? I mean, most of those guys were not. Some of them were, but at least in background. But these are movements that are anti-religious generally, and they certainly are not consistent with Judaism. And yes, Jews are attracted to it. And I think one of the reasons why you find more Jews getting into this than Catholics is because we don't have a pope. We don't have a messiah. We don't have a Vatican.
I agree with you.
So we don't have.
Let me agree with you, okay? Why are Jews attracted to political messianic movements? Because they don't have a messiah. This is compensation for the fact that they did not accept the messiah. That's the premise of the book.
Well, you're partially right. Some Jews are attracted to this. What I'm suggesting to you, however, is that those Jews are in apostasy, because Judaism has continued as an organic, dynamic faith. Even Jesus of Nazareth recognized that. You can take a look at the book of Matthew and the book of Acts, where Jesus said, according to the Gospels, that the covenant between the Jewish people, the Judeans, and God is forever. And forever means forever. I mean, it's a covenantal faith that has continued uninterrupted from the time of Adam up until today. It's not something that fosters these radicals. I mean, yes, Jews go into those things. Reasons that are complicated.
Let's go back to that. There's an Abrahamic covenant, and that includes everyone. There's a Mosaic covenant, which is specifically for the Jews. And you have to fulfill certain requirements in order to fulfill the Mosaic covenant.
Correct.
As of the time of Christ, the Jews could not fulfill those requirements anymore because they needed a temple. I'm saying because of this vacuum, they were attracted to these messianic political movements. Now, obviously, not every single Jew is going to be attracted to these movements. Okay, there was the reaction to Shabbatai Zevi was in many ways a quietism of the Hasidim. Okay, these are not revolutionaries, obviously. Okay, but there is this vacuum, and you have this attraction to these messianic movements that gets cloaked in Jewish terms, like Tikkun Olam, for example. You suddenly have this duty to kind of heal the world, completely divorced from any type of religious sanction. Any Jew can
No. Tikkun alum.
This is what's been happening here. Tikkun magazine has an article by Amy Dean talking about gay marriage. Okay, if it weren't for the Jews, we wouldn't have gay marriage. That's Amy Dean's statement. When I say it, they call me an anti-Semite. Amy Dean clearly sees gay marriage as part of Tikkun Olam.
Tikkun Olam is a communist magazine. Tikkun Olam, the concept, which goes back to ancient times, is to repair the world by doing good deeds as an individual, not conquering the world, but by leading by example. It's actually more of a Catholic concept, because I know that the Catholics engage in proselytizing, not by the way Protestants do, by going out the street and knocking people around. They do it through example. They do it by observing the faith, by showing throughout their own good life what it means to be Catholic, and that attracts people. That's what Tikkun Olam is. It's basically improving your own life. It's not conquering the world.
Well, explain to me why Amy Dean thinks that gay marriage is an example of Tikkun Olam. Explain that because
she's a communist. That's why. I'd like to take a look at whether she believes in God. Is she kosher? Does she observe Shabbos? Is she in any way a Jew? Probably not. She's a commie. That's why. And so is Rabbi Michael Lerner, who was part of the 60s counterculture. And it was very, very separate from Judaism. I've interviewed him on my show. I mean, I can attest to that.
Okay. I just don't see it that way, because now we have a conservatism. This was the problem that I confronted before. Okay, Bolshevism was a Jewish political movement, so it's commies are the problem.
No, it's not a Jewish movement.
Bolshevism could not have succeeded without Jewish participation.
I reject that.
And leadership.
I reject that. Bolshevism succeeded because it got international left-wing support, mainly in the United States. And as I said before, and I don't want to talk around in circles here, there were a lot of Jews who got sucked into that movement, and some of them were among the worst, very prominent Jews. And that's something that I would argue, and I've argued it controversially among my own Jewish circles, that Judaism needs to come to terms with. We need to own that. And we need to say, we have been in error here. We have gotten involved in a heresy that, it's not unlike the Christians getting involved in the Hussite movement and the Adamites in Bohemia. It was a communistic movement that transcended and rejected all of the things that Judaism is about. Judaism is about private property. It's about the rights of free trade in goods and services. It's about family values. It's about belief in God, education, not the tearing these things down. It's anathema to Jewish sensibilities. And unfortunately, I think since Shabtai Zvi and the advent of Bolshevism, these ideas have seriously compromised Judaism, because people in positions of influence have taken the reins of power within Judaism and they've corrupted it. I think Christianity has been compromised by these things as well. Not as much, because as I say, with the Catholics, they've got certain guidelines. They've got a Vatican, they've got a Pope that can confront it. And that's a plus. Protestantism has been corrupted by it. Take a look at some of the Protestant churches. I mean, they're about as communist as you can get.
Yeah. Except that there's a conservative strain of Judaism that is every bit as revolutionary as the communist strain of Judaism. Zionism. Is Zionism communism? Is Zionism a form of communism?
No,
it's not. Is it a messianic movement?
Partially, yes. But it's not communist. It's simply the desire of the Jewish people to return to the land that was God gave us when God told Abraham to go up to this land. It is a part of Judaism. It does set the stage for the coming of a Messiah. That's true. But it's not in any way communist. It's not calling for conquest of the world. It's not a redistribution of wealth. It's not authoritarian.
I agree with you. It's the opposite of communism. It is Jewish nationalism, and communism is Jewish internationalism. Okay, so you're right there. It's the exact opposite of communism, but it's still a messianic Jewish movement. And I'm saying, unless, unless we can't confuse the part for the whole here. Okay. So both at the Pale of the Settlement during the 19th century, you had two competing ideologies for the mind of the Jews. 80% of the world's Jews are living there. One is communism, one is Zionism. The first messianic ideology that really took hold was communism, socialism, whatever you want to call it. And that had its reign all the way up until, let's say, 67. Okay, 67, there's a turning point in American Jewry. Okay, they're suddenly realizing that the civil rights movement is turning sour. Okay, you have the Ocean Hill Brownsville school boycott, the strike there, which where the blacks take control of the school system, they kick out all the Jewish teachers, and suddenly you have this wave of disillusionment spreading through the Jewish population in America, and they switch their allegiance from communism to Zionism. And now we got a new political movement. Now we have a new messianic movement. And I'm saying the only continuity here, it's not left wing, right wing. It's Jewish and it's messianic politics. And it goes all the way back to this vacuum that was created because they don't have a Messiah. That's the point of my book.
Okay. I mean, I just would, you know, it's interesting. And it's, I think that there's a lot of truth to it. However, the issue of Zionism is a very modest and proper view, which goes back to the most ancient of times. And that is that for whatever reason, and it's a mystery to me, I'm not a rabbi, but the Jewish people, God told us to take possession of that tiny little swath of land between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. That's what the Torah tells us. That's what the writings tell us. That's what the prophets tell us. And that's what this is. And now if you want to say it's nationalist, sure. They want to have an independent nation state over there in the same way that other people want to have their own nation states. I mean, you know, the United States is nationalist in a sense, but there is a messianic element to it. But and that a lot of the early Zionists were on the left. But, you know, when history is written, we'll realize that Zionism also was a religious movement. It was a conservative movement as well. Those voices didn't get prominence in Israel until actually Menachem Begin. Israel today is a vibrant, dynamic, relatively free society. It is a Jewish state, and it's also a secular state. It balances both. And, you know, now we see something in the news even today where, because of the Faisal-Weizmann Accord, which was signed in 1919, by which King Faisal recognized Israel as in modest and proper borders with respect for the Muslim minority and Islamic holy places, that is starting to actually move in a direction where, and he did it because he wanted Arab and Muslim states to also become independent from the European colonialists and develop vibrant societies as well. And he knew the Jews in Israel, which was called Palestine during the British time, could help with that. That seems to be becoming true almost now. As apparently Netanyahu just visited Oman and he was received openly, and Oman is talking about formally recognizing Israel, as are some of the other Gulf states. Even Pakistan now is talking about normalizing relations with Israel. So Israel's relations in that region, which is as a small Jewish state living peaceably alongside Islamic states, of which there are over 25, and all working to develop modern societies with technologies and economies and democracies, that's becoming more and more true.
Chuck, I hate to contradict you here, but I was in Mashhad in Iran at a conference, and behind us there was a large TV screen, and as we're talking, we're watching Israeli snipers in real time shooting Palestinians, okay? Palestinians with rocks, Palestinians trying to run away, Palestinian women and children. This is not a peaceful state. This is once again.
I reject that.
Once again, well, I mean, I was there. I was watching them.
Yeah, but Israel is under attack. Why is Gaza? Israel handed Gaza to the Palestinian Authority, stripping the Jewish population out of it, forcing people to leave it. They gave them training. They gave them money. The world poured money in. they could have created in Gaza the equivalent of the French Riviera. This is beachfront property. It's not a poor place. You know, that could have been like Hong Kong. Instead, they use it as a launching pad against Israel itself. They fired 6,000 rockets into Israel. They built terror tunnels to go under the border so they could come in and kill as many Jews as they can. Israel could very easily go in and drop a fucking bomb on that place and end it. But instead, they have pinpointedly tried to get only the people who are trying to kill Jews, not innocent people. Innocent people are killed. But if Israel wanted to, like, for example, during the Hamas war, Israel sent Jewish soldiers into Gaza to find these terrorists and stop them. And in the process, there were 85 Jewish lives killed. They didn't have to do it that way. They could have done it the way Syria does it, just drop a bomb on Homs and kill 30,000 people. So Israel has a record, given the assault that they're under, of very great restraint. Their policy is to just go after those who are firing the rockets, not innocent people. It is a war, however. And in a war, innocent people are killed. It's not a war that Israel's asking for. Israel gave the Gaza to Palestinian Authority. They would be more than willing to help them develop a sovereign state there and then do more, you know, but it didn't happen that way.
Chuck, I don't want to get into a debate about what's happening in Gaza. I think that it's a horrendous situation. I think that Israel is at fault. I think that they stole the land from the Palestinian people, and they've created a large concentration camp for the Palestinians, and the goal is the extermination of the Palestinian people.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
That's my point of view. I want to take a step back from that, though. I want to talk about, this was the example here. Okay, we were watching Israeli snipers shoot Palestinians. There's no dispute about that fact. It's a fact. It happened.
Yeah, people throwing rockets at them. They weren't trying to kill. You think they were trying to say, oh, there's a woman or a child. Let's go kill them? Is that what you think? I mean, this is an outrage. You know, that you would say that Israel's trying to annihilate people? That's outrageous.
I'd like to take a step back. Yes, the answer is yes, I think they are trying to annihilate.
That's an outrage, and I reject that vehemently.
Okay, but anyway, I'd just like to take a step back
okay. And
say what we have here are two sides. We're in the middle of a struggle right now between J Street Jews and Likudniks over who's, let's say, responsible for the shooting in Pittsburgh. You have two competing explanations here. The J Street Jews are attacking Trump. They don't like Trump. They're the left-wing Jews. The right-wing Jews are now supporting Trump. And they're even going to the point of saying, well, maybe it was okay to kill this guy Khashoggi because he was probably a terrorist anyway. They're supporting Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia is at war with Iran and they need allies in the war with Iran. That explains this collaboration. What I'm saying here is there's a message that's coming out here from both the right-wing Jews and the left-wing Jews. It's not a right-left issue. The right-wing Jews are gunning down people in Palestine. The left-wing Jews...
I reject that.
All right. The left-wing Jews support abortion. Do you reject that too?
Yes, I do. And I think that left-wing Catholics will support abortion as well, like Joe Biden and like Nancy Pelosi and like, Cuomo. I mean, these are professing Catholics. I heard Joe Biden say, I'm a professing Catholic who supports abortion. Why hasn't the Catholic Church excommunicated him?
I'm not saying that Jews are the only people who support abortion. My claim is that left-wing
Jews don't support abortion. You know, there are some left-wingers in Judaism that do. Now, I'll admit, the Jewish position on abortion is a little more liberal than the Catholic position. That I'll grant you. You know, there were rabbis who got together, I think sometime in the Middle Ages, and they debated the issue for over a year. And they said, you know, we don't want to be seen as less religious than the Pope. But eventually they did come to an agreement that the spirit doesn't enter the womb until 40 days after conception. So, Judaism is a little more liberal than Catholicism. on that question, not as liberal as Islam, which allows abortion right up to the day of birth, and not as liberal as Roe versus Wade either. But yeah, we are a little more liberal on the issue.
And I'm saying, if it weren't for Jews, abortion would never have been legalized.
Reject that. Was Harry Blackmun a Jew? He was a Catholic. He was a Christian.
This is the statement of Bernard Nathanson, who was one of the two Jews who basically created the abortion movement in New York State. That's his testimony. He said, if it weren't for these Jews from New York City, the country never would have legalized abortion. The same thing is true of California. The leading force there was Jewish in promoting, and basically all that the Supreme Court did with Roe versus Wade was ratify the New York and California position on abortion. Both of those places were dominated by Jews. If it weren't for the Jews, we would not have abortion. If it weren't for the Jews, Jewish leadership, we would not have had Bolshevism. All I'm trying to do with this book is connect the dots. And I'm trying to say this.
Yeah, but you are right to point out these individuals with Jewish backgrounds, and I'd have to look into how Jewish they were, as being a part of these liberal movements. It is not, however, consistent with Judaism. It is not consistent with conventional Jewish practice. It is not consistent with Jewish theology. Jewish theology does not endorse abortion. You have individuals who might.
If you were the Jewish Pope, I would accept your position. But you're just Chuck Morse. There is no one who has the definitive right to say this is what is Jewish and this is not what is Jewish.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. We don't have, we don't have a stronger centralized figure as a pope with a hierarchy and a Vatican and all the rest. But there is a body of work that goes back to ancient times and that has continued in every generation, where you have Torah true, legitimate Talmudic rabbis, most of whom I suppose you'd call Orthodox, although the word Orthodox isn't even, relevant. I mean, they're just conventional Jews who do have rulings, and they are based upon, precedent, and they are going back to the Torah, who do take positions on these things. Now, you also have these breakaway movements like Reform and Conservative. That's something else. But the fact is that there is a conventional.
Let's take Netanyahu.
Who?
Netanyahu.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
They are saying that we are true to the Torah, and if you're true to the Torah, you cannot accept Zionism. Is that right?
That's ridiculous. That's wrong. And, they're in error. Zionism is a part of Judaism, has been a part of every generation. Every day when we go to the synagogue, we pray for the time when we can return to Jerusalem. That's what it is, an integral part of Judaism. It is commanded in the Torah going back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They're wrong. Now, I understand that they say this because they're resentful over the fact that a very large number of the Zionists were liberals and they were political, so therefore they're concerned about the purity of the Jewish people, whether we're ready to assume control of Zion. That's really what that's about. Not that they're anti-Zionist. They're anti-Zionism as it's constructed presently. I would simply point to you that they're wrong about that, because the fact that Jews live in Israel today, even if they're not religious, they are fulfilling a large percentage of the precepts of the Torah just by being there.
Okay, so let me just say from a goy perspective here, okay? Here I am, I'm this goy on the outside, just looking in, trying to figure this thing out, because it's confusing. It's confusing. So here you're saying the Netarai Karta, they're not real Jews because they don't accept Zionism. And the left-wing Jews, they're not real Jews because they have been, it's communism, and that's not, well, they would say the same thing about you.
Well, look, first of all, Naturi Carter, they are real Jews, but they are in error.
Okay, I understand that, but you're not the Pope. You're not the Jewish Pope. Just trying to say, look, I'm trying to give you my point of view as the goy.
All right, fine. I mean, look, we don't agree on everything. We don't have, and I respect that. I mean, look, I could talk to an Irish cab driver who's going to look at this conversation and listen to it on his podcast and scratch his head and say, you know, what do the Jews think? It is a complicated question, but we do have a central body of work that is consistent, that does start with the Torah and goes through the Talmud, which indicates a general theme that builds up. It's not contradictory. It's like the way the Supreme Court works on interpreting the Constitution. I mean, they may be in errors from time to time, but we do have a constitution in this country, and we can interpret it sometimes wrongly, but it exists. It's real. It is the law of the land. The same thing with Judaism. We have a constitution. It's called the Torah, and the Talmud interprets it like a Supreme Court, and present rabbis who are Torah true continue that tradition. Now, that doesn't mean that we have an answer to everything. I don't think the Pope has an answer to everything. Look at the Pope recently said that he was okay with gay marriage, didn't he?
No.
Okay, I could be wrong. I might be wrong about that.
The statement was, who am I to judge? And that didn't have to do with gay marriage.
What do you mean, who is he to judge? He's the Pope. I want him to judge. I mean, I'm not Catholic.
There
and I looked to the Pope and
disagreed with the Pope when he said that. There are plenty of guys who disagree.
But I can tell you that as a non-Catholic, as a Catholic Gentile, if you will, I look to the Catholic Church for moral authority.
Okay, let me. As I said, I'm just a dumb guy on the outside looking in, and I'm trying to make sense of this thing. But there are other Jews who agree with me. Okay, there are a lot of Jews who agree with me, and one of the things that I tried to present in this book was that there was a Catholic position on dealing with the Jews that I think was successful. And that was secret Judaeus non. Okay, 1,500 years of the church has to deal with the Jews. Oh, what's the principle here? First principle, no one has the right to harm the Jew. Okay, second principle, the Jew has no right to destroy your culture by undermining faith and morals. I think that's a workable solution. But the problem here is that I'm in a situation where when I say something like this, I'm immediately shouted down by all of the official Jewish organizations like the ADL as an anti-Semite.
Well, I don't agree with that.
Does the ADL speak for Jews?
No, and I don't think you're an anti-Semite. I think you have a traditional anti-Jewish opinion in the same way that I might have an anti-Muslim opinion.
I agree with you completely if you say that something like the Gospel of St. John is anti-Jewish. It is anti-Jewish.
It
There's
is.
There's a battle going on between the Jews who accepted Jesus Christ and the Jews who rejected Jesus Christ, and that's what that gospel is about. It's
sure.
about that conflict, and all I'm saying is that conflict continued from there all the way up to the Kavanaugh hearings. It's not going to go away.
No, it's not. It's not going to be resolved either. And it's not going to be reconciled because you have two very different views on the nature of Jesus and a lot of the things that emanate from that.
So I
accept that.
The point I'm trying to make here is, let's take this Pittsburgh thing. Let's take what happened in Pittsburgh. Okay. This is a guy who walks in and guns down all of these Jews. Okay, and now they're going to use this to come after me. Okay, they can't stop those guys. There's no way in the world anybody here knows who the next guy is going to pick up a gun and walk into a Walmart or a school or a synagogue or whatever. Okay, and I'm saying this is self-defeating behavior. Okay, or maybe
I agree with you to politicize this. And I think that synagogues, like probably a lot of churches, they need to be a little bit more careful about making sure there are people with arms in there, and security.
All right, you can say that, but I'm saying that what the ADL engages in is self-defeating behavior because they go after. I've spent 10 years saying the first principle is do not harm the Jew. Okay, and they've called me an anti-Semite for 10 years. That's not anti-Semitism. I'm sorry.
Okay. And look, I'm not a big fan of the ADL. I think they've been very much controlled by the left establishment, in the same way that the National Council of Churches is very communistic.
That's what I'm saying, but we have to face up to this fact. You know, it's not just you and me.
Judaism's been compromised by the left, as has a large portion of Christianity. That's the problem. Not our faiths, our respective faiths, which we don't agree, but that doesn't matter. The fact is that even Islam, to an extent, has been radicalized by forces that might be emphasizing more radical parts of that faith at the expense of other parts. You know, it's a political problem. It's not, is in a sense, much more than a religious problem, certainly with regard to Judaism. Anyways, but we're reaching toward the end of the program, so I kind of want to wrap it up. I hope I can have you back as I continue reading this excellent book. Let me hold it up again. Yes. And I thank you.
I want to say, Chuck, this is what I've been hoping for. For 10 years, I've been hoping for some type of dialogue on this issue. And I'm grateful for you to give me the opportunity to talk, because logos is the basis of what we are as human beings. And logos is, in the first instance, speech and dialogue. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk to you.
All right. As am I, Michael Jones. Listen, Michael, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. We should do it again soon. And I really appreciate your spending the time.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.